the ideas, the leaders, the lives that are shaping Denmark and the world. From Blocks Hub in Copenhagen, Denmark, with your co-hosts, Ed Lay and Thomas Molhern, this is Global Denmark.
Hello and welcome to the Global Denmark podcast, where we explore how thought leaders and innovators are working to create a better Denmark and a better world. Today we had the great pleasure of sitting down with Natasha Friis-Saxbøl. She is an author, digital strategist and entrepreneur. She'd worked with startups and large organizations in technology for two decades. She's previously been the head of venture development for Maersk Growth. She's a TEDx speaker. She was head of future growth at ETA. She's the deputy chair of Fonden for Social Advar. She's been the founder of several SaaS startups on the global market and much, much more. In this wide-ranging conversation, we explored the first technological revolution, or the fourth industrial revolution, the value chain evolution and horizontal collaboration, innovation teams within corporations, accelerating growth in startups, and much, much more. This is a fantastic episode. Without further ado, we bring you Natasha Friis-Saxbøl.
We are back. I am here as always with my co-host, Mr. Ed Lay. Ed, tell me about your life.
Where to start? Wow. No. In fact, I'm going to throw it right back to you. How are you?
Equally a no. And we are here with today's guest.
Should I say yes now?
Yes. Miss Natasha Friis-Saxbøl. Thank you so much for coming by the studio.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we want to dive right in. And you are a expert in tech, I think.
Thank
we
you.
Could safely say.
Thank you.
But we want to know, what is tech's impact, biggest impact right now? And how does that tie together with what we're hearing is the fourth industrial revolution?
So the fourth industrial revolution is, as I see it, a paradigm of opportunities that we have with technology, where technology is not the goal, but the means to reach more optimized levels in industries. And as we've seen previously with industrial revolutions, is that they change things dramatically. And we don't know where we're going to go. We don't know how, but we know that it's going to create a big disruptive change for many companies and societies and humans. So I think it's the same challenge we're facing. Some says that we shouldn't call it an industrial revolution. We should call it the first technological revolution, the first digital revolution, because it's fundamentally very, very different from the previous revolutions we've had. But I think technology has just shown us that we're actually able to accelerate our evolution as a species much faster than we've done before. And that always creates a lot of challenges because our minds are not able to predict what's going to happen. We can see it with artificial intelligence and the ethics around that and data and privacy, that we throw technology out there and then suddenly a lot of problems comes back to us and we're thinking we can stop it, but we can't stop it anymore. So we're losing control and on the same time, we're also not moving fast enough because we have a world that's suffering and we have to create new structures. We have to figure out how we can live more in balance and still have all the pleasures we're enjoying today and the standards we're having in our lives today. And that is a very interesting challenge for us to face. And the fourth industrial revolution is just one path towards that. I think sustainability, impact, UN's sustainable development goals is a more present agenda that is challenging a lot of industries today, where industrial revolution is a part of that, but we need to figure out how we can create a more sustainable world and make money at the same time.
And when did this supposedly begin, this first technological revolution or the fourth industrial? Is there a time frame was there an event that kicked this off?
I think there's been many events. So to make it a little bit black and white, in the 90s we saw a lot of innovation within hardware, and after the millennium we experienced a lot of software innovation. So two geeks could sit in a garage and do Facebook or Twitter and all these other great stories we've experienced. And since 2010 we've seen much more what we call digital innovation, which is combining the physical and the virtual world. And in my personal view, I think the next 10 years, we're going to see value chain innovation. We're going to see a lot of ways of working in industries that we need to reinvent across the value chains. And the reason we need to look across value chains is that that's where all the optimization will lie. We've been optimizing silos and verticals and individual industries for so many decades now that the real potential is across value chains, across partners, sectors. And that's always, and that's also the very, very difficult part, because when you need to collaborate with other people and other companies, it becomes difficult.
Indeed.
But it ties very well into the sustainability agenda, that you need to be responsible for what happens outside your own silo or your own company or your own industry. You need to understand your effect on the world. So we also need the established industries. We need the asset owners of the world. We cannot put two people into a garage and fix it with an app. It's more substantial.
You said that it's difficult. Collaboration is difficult. Could you talk more about that? Why is it difficult, and what do we need to look out for?
I think the structures we've designed for the past century has been very vertical oriented. So the organizational structure is one example. Democracy, capitalism is another example. We've been extremely good at making sure we could measure and lead and control into one area, one silo. But we haven't really managed to create structures that could work across silos. And I think that's the challenge and the paradigm change we're facing right now, is that our organizations are incompatible with the challenges we're facing in the world. And the reason why it's so difficult is because we don't have those horizontal structures. We don't know how to incentivize people to work with each other. And the way we've designed organizations is very much to create islands and isolate ourselves from the world, tell ourselves we're the greatest in the world at what we do, and we should not talk to too many people outside our company. That's inefficient. We need to focus. So we created an echo chamber within organizations and industries. And I think just starting by talking to people outside our natural sphere, scientists, venture capitalists, startups for companies, industries, if you're a startup, that will open up for the opportunities that will be to collaborate. But that is even hard in a corporation. I don't know how many startups I've met that just makes tools to make people talk inside an organization. So collaboration is difficult for what we don't know and what we don't see. And that's how we've structured our world so far.
Are you seeing any best practices on the ground in terms of companies or industries that are tearing up the old model and could really lead the way?
I think tech industries are probably the ones that are showing us the next design of organizations the most. I don't believe we're there yet, but I think they're experimenting with ways of working that will be the future of organizations. So you have an example is Google X. So that's their innovation department. What they're looking at is problems. They're scouting the world for problems, and they're talking to anyone to figure out which problems are big in the world and how can we convert that into big business or data that can create business. And I think that curiosity around not being idea-driven but being problem-driven will make us or force us to talk to other people. Because a problem can be universal, an idea is very much a symptom of a problem.
And what problems are coming up most frequently that the companies could seek to fix to fill those voids?
There are many, but if we look at UN Sustainable Development Goals, I'm just going to call them the SDGs from now on to make this program shorter.
Yep.
I think that's a very good place to start, because you actually have 17 goals, and within those you have a lot of targets and a lot of activities you can work on. And I think each company will find a way to create a goal within an SDG. So you have Grundfos, the Danish company, that has changed their mission to say we want to deliver clean water to 300 million people. We are an SDG 6 and SDG 13 company.
300 million people that aren't currently getting clean water.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And SDG 6 is water and 13 is climate action. So that's one way of addressing it, saying make a quantitative goal that says we want to do something bigger in the world. In the old good old days, you had a mission saying we want to sell more products. Now it's we want to solve a big problem in the world. And when you open up the scope of your vision, you also open up the scope of people you need to talk to, your potential new revenue streams, your new partnerships, new technologies. So the growth of the future will be to understand which role do you play in the bigger problems in the world and translating that into growth. And that's what Google X has been done for quite a while, understanding if there's no bandwidth in emerging markets or in areas where you have disaster, natural disasters, how can we provide, as an example, with the Loon project they had, how can we make sure they get internet access so we can get the data and get help out and information out, etc. So for companies, it's doing what Grundfos has done, translating what they do into a bigger problem where they can become a better solution.
And why should companies do that?
Because that's where the future of growth will be. And I think we, a Grundfos that sells water pumps, amongst other things, or a mask that transports goods around the world, or whatever we have of industries, we've saturated the growth within our verticals. So if you look at the margins on existing industries, they're saturated. They're not growing very much in most industries. Mm. So we have to look for new growth. And that will not be in the silos because we all already squeeze them as much as we could. Mm. So we have to look beyond our product, beyond our industry. And what Amazon is showing us, maybe the most clear example of, is that industries are converging. So you can't say we're in shipping or we're in water or we're in energy. You'll see industries converging more and more because if you go across the value chain, you'll be in shipping. You'll also be in finance. You're also going to be in health. So that's what's confusing organizations today is that the growth is probably not in the industry as you define it today. It might be a combination of several industries in the future. Right. And if you don't establish those connections into those potential new industries in time, someone else will do it. And then you're going to be having that exponential decay instead of the exponential growth we're seeing it, especially tech companies.
Do you think a lot of the chaos that's happening in the world at the moment is a result of that uncertainty of the future and what technology is going to mean for all of our jobs?
Oh, which chaos are you talking about? Because I can think politics and say, my God, the chaos has changed there. And I think geopolitics or politics has changed dramatically because we're not having wars with military or guns anymore. It's war of data. It's technology that we're competing on a political level as well. Mm. So suddenly, and that has surfaced very much the past 5 years. The Chinese has known this for decades. We've just ignored it. But suddenly it becomes a war on who has the most skilled people, who has the most data, who has the most money in those companies that are producing this. And the problem with that chaos is that if you're not in that race on time, you can't just follow on and say, okay, we're gonna run a bit faster because it is exponential. So if you as a country are gathering as much data as they are in China right now, it's really hard to compete in 5 years because that data lies the foundation for the artificial intelligence, the machine learning, all these new ways of handling your society that is based on data that is exponential. So you can't just as a country say, oh, too bad they have so much data in the world and they are leading in artificial intelligence. We're going to find some money and we're going to reach in on them. That's not going to happen.
Where does that leave us with there being probably 10 companies that have more data than most countries?
That is a huge dilemma because they're going to practically have more power than any country. And I think that's what China recognized a while ago, is that if we leave that to the market, we're going to lose that power. So that they've been really, really good at centralizing that development into the country and excluding or isolating companies from the outside coming in. So they understood that very, very early.
Which is anti-democratic and anti-free market capitalism.
Exactly. So there's not... We can't look at it with our values and say that's great at all. Right. And we're also seeing how they're using it on minorities right now. So
we see these competing paths of one is the most efficient way to channel the data, which is the future of growth. But it goes in contrast to the same values that are part of the Danish state and the EU and these things.
Mm. And I think we're seeing...
So what to do with that?
I think the European Union... It has a huge potential of playing a big role on this because you have the states in America, the data belongs to the market. In China, the data belongs to the state. And in Europe, it belongs to the citizen. So if we can create a framework that makes sure that we can maintain our privacy and our rights to our own data. We do have a potential to spread that into the rest of the world because that will be a demand. But when we haven't been fast enough so far. We also have a complex situation because we're a lot of countries with different languages. We're China, one country, more than 1 billion people, 1.3 billion people, or 1.2 at this time, I think. Mm. You have the States, also a big country, and with a universal language. So you have so much more data, whereas in Denmark or in France or Germany, the countries, because of the language, it becomes just smaller data pools. So we are challenged, but we also have an opportunity to figure out how we can solve this on a global level for each citizen. I don't have the solution. If I had, I would be probably doing something much more.
But we talked off air about...
You'd still be here.
Of course. Outside of the studio, I would be doing something very, very important.
We talked off air about changing incentivization structures as a potential remedy for getting people to buy into this. What do you mean by that? How can we incentivize... stakeholders to really move in this direction?
I think my pain point is starting with that. I see a lot of companies talk about technology, and it's so easy to talk about technology and all the wonders of innovation. But I've also seen every time you come with technology or products or solutions, it's not the technology that prevents it from happening. It's people, it's systemic barriers, it's structures, it's bureaucracy. So what I mean about incentive structures is that we're never going to leverage the potential of technology if we don't give people an incentive for embracing it. And in most organizations, the leaders, the decision makers, they are not incentivized by tomorrow's business and the experimentation we're doing in the future. They're incentivized of short-term profits and maintaining the business of yesterday. Mm-hmm. And not that they shouldn't do it, because that pays out salary to everyone. So we need to figure out how we can work in dual modes, and that's back to how we can design a new way of leading our organizations, which embrace development and embraces profit, which embraces short term and embraces long term.
Yes.
So it's this musicality within our way of leading that we need to unfold even more and develop even more. So if we want to create real change, we need to make sure that the leaders of today get incentivized for the business of tomorrow. Otherwise, they'll be afraid, because most of them are generalists, and I think it's very easy to become a generalist if you're a leader or just when your career is moving ahead. It's rare you stay as a specialist. Mm-hmm. And as a generalist, you won't really understand new technologies and the potential in your role. So making sure that the people have the insight for what will blockchain, how can that potentially affect your business, how will AI affect your business, and all these other magic technologies out there. If you're not getting the support you need to understand the potential, you're not going to get the visions that will make you set new projects or develop new ideas for your organization or create new partnerships, so you make sure you have that knowledge close.
And I think as a leader, one of the things you can do as a generalist in that way is show that you're willing to come out of your comfort zone and embrace that fear, the uncertainty, to prioritize innovation and experimentalization.
Yeah. What we're seeing right now is a breed of leadership, which is which distinguishes management from leadership. And I think if we look around in our own worlds, we know who the leaders are. That is the people who believe in a vision that is bigger than themselves. The managers are maintaining a career with no errors so they can get their next career move and get their next bonus. Mm-hmm. So they're really more worried about their own identity and their own career move, where the leaders believe in something that's bigger than themselves. And I think we're going to see a pivot towards this modern leader, which thinks bigger, is more courageous, but is able to also maintain that business that creates the cash today. So it is that duality of we shouldn't just grab everything that works and pays out the salary, but we need to have an experimental mindset that is looking at risk in a new way and errors in a new way. Because with any ventures, whether it was Columbus that had to discover the world or us that has to figure out how we're going to save the world within 10 years, and we don't know how, we will not know how to achieve this. So we have to take small steps and learn very fast and fail very fast. And I think that's crucial.
So humans are obviously naturally risk averse, and probably half people move towards risk and half people will stay away from risk. And you mentioned that that currently leaders are incentivized, or managers or CEOs, let's say, are incentivized by making the profit today and fear of what they don't know. How can we remove the fear? What do leaders today need to know in order to remove enough fear for them to start taking risks?
It's a good question.
Thanks.
My take on it, and there's probably many more, but I think one take is making sure that they get an experimental pool to work with. That, yes, you have to maintain the P&L of today, but you also need to prove how you're going to develop the business in the future. So you will not be a success only by delivering short-term profits. You also have to make sure we have a business in 3 or 5 or 7 years. And a way of doing that is measuring more on not the quantitative, but the qualitative measures. So how many people or partnerships are you engaging in? How many people are you making sure you include in giving you the knowledge you need to see the visions? Are you networking enough? Are you collaborating enough? Are you experimenting enough? Are you failing enough? Because there's not one solution. And I think that's the discrepancy between the old model and the new model, is that in yesterday's business, we had to make a business plan and a cost-benefit analysis, and we have to keep those goals. Otherwise, it was a failure. It is impossible to use those same structures and tools for this new paradigm. We need to set goals for what we need to learn in order to make better decisions.
And how do you see the difference between kind of the Danish market and other markets in terms of achieving this? And the reason I ask is because we know Denmark is a monoculture that's traditionally exclusive to external elements. But what you're saying is that you need an inclusive, holistic growth mindset outside of the way you normally think of things. Do you see any differences in...
I think the Danish or the Nordic value proposition, we're probably a little bit similar with our Nordic neighbors, is that we have a low level of bureaucracy. So I could probably get some minister on the phone if I really wanted to. I could figure out who we have in common in our network, and I could talk to that person, or I could find any CEO's email address and reach out. So it's really easy for Danes to get access across sectors and across levels in a society. So that's one area. I think the other area is, even though we have that culture you're describing, we also know we're deeply dependent on the world, that we need to think differently, we need to promote ourselves differently. So many of the, if you look at the companies we have in Denmark, the global reach they have, that's Novo, Grundfos, Maersk, Vestas, there's so many, Lego, I could continue. It's quite extraordinary for such a little country to have so many global industry leaders. And I think that is our savior, that even though it is Danish companies and we have the limitations, we are also around, we are present all over the world. And what we underestimate as Danes or Nordic people is that if you tell people in South America or in Africa or in Asia that you're a Danish company, that alone comes with some trust, because you're probably not as corrupt as the next door business. And the solutions you're providing are probably of a higher quality. So we just have a quality stamp by being Nordic or Danish that gives us a head start in many markets. And that is what we need to leverage even more, understanding that position. And if you're looking at the climate challenges, we are actually front runners within renewable energy. We've built a smart grid and based on a green electricity that can actually give us a leading position in what we call power to X. So we have a lot of sustainable electricity, and if we can convert that to other resources, Brent, ammonia, etc. We have a chance right now, but that window is pretty small, so we need to move fast. And we have a chance because our society's levels of hierarchy are so low and flat.
The key decision makers here in this equation, as we know, in top leadership in Denmark, it's a specific profile, right? And we're talking about a white male baby boomer, 90% of the time.
Exactly. And they are close connected, and we're very closely connected to the political landscape as well. So the government just launched the climate partnerships, where 13 areas are being addressed with an industry leader owning them. Typically, I think most of them are owned by industry leaders. So you're asking the industry to make a roadmap for how they're going to reach Denmark's goal in 2030 on reducing CO2 by 70%. So I think we're very good at working across sectors. And because everyone knows everyone in this small country, we can make things work that can be scaled in the world. And we shouldn't remember what's launched and in production and mature in Denmark is the equal size of a pilot in India or in Africa. But we're able to prove those models in that way.
Sorry, to backpedal just a little bit, you mentioned before a new way of thinking that needs to be adopted by companies. And a lot of the things you were describing seem to be what a need that companies might meet by having an innovation hub, as we often call them. Could you speak to how companies are doing that and how they're doing it right and how they're doing it wrong, in your opinion?
So corporate innovation has become very popular in the past five years. And I think everyone had something called Project X or Corporate Garage or some kind of innovation lab on their to-do list. And many companies have done some kind of innovation exercise, from creating an innovation lab or corporate garage or a venture department. And I think the first breed of those examples haven't worked very well because it was isolated from the core of the business. So it was a funny department where you bought three fat boys and a good coffee machine, and then you were innovative.
Isn't that the magic formula?
It is. It works everywhere. Mm-hmm. And
I've got a coffee.
Yeah, you need to get a fat boy in here. And either as an employee, you were envy of all the luxury and the goods they had in that fancy department. They didn't need to ask to buy a pen. They could just buy a pen or whatever. Or you really wanted to work there. So suddenly it became the place you wanted to be, which was in contradiction with the core. And then what I've experienced from working in many of these in from development to venture is that over time, when you need help from the core, it's really hard to get it, because they haven't been a part of the journey. And back to incentives, they aren't incentivized to help you. And everyone is busy. So why should I put down my work or work more to help you on some goals in a department that has a fat boy and a fancy coffee machine without me getting anything out of it besides a good coffee that day?
Sure. So you've created this minority subculture.
Yes.
That's not benefiting from the core.
Yes. And it has, I think, what we need to, and again, this is only my opinion, but I think these Project X's are an interim for the future of organizations. So until we get the future way of leading organizations, we have to have these dual mode organizations. So the Project X of the Innovation Lab is more the place you can work agile and be networking and look at the company from the outside in, instead of being inside out focused. But what I've seen not working is that the knowledge, all the great knowledge that they get in these innovation departments, the network they get access to, is not reaching the core of the business. And that's why they need to get the knowledge in order to adjust or to get inspired for the strategies and the choices they make. Because this is merely, if you send out a ship into the world to discover land, these are small ships you're sending out to say, well, there's something happening around mm-hmm. blockchain, or right now, customers are really asking for better solutions within this area. So it's your scouts, and if you don't get that knowledge back into the company, it's just been an innovation theater exercise more than a strategic exercise. So I think many of these initiatives, they start out very well, where an executive board says, "We want to have something that thinks long term. We want some innovation. We expect in return within 5 or 7 years." And what always happens is that after 2 years, the board or the business saying, could you please show us some results, because it would be really nice for our shareholders and stakeholders to see something now. And then you diverge the innovation department or the venture department closer and closer to the core. And then it becomes obsolete, because if you really want to experiment, you shouldn't be it shouldn't be too recognizable.
Yes.
But then the fear comes in. And if you hire someone to lead that innovation lab that has a career inside the organization or been inside the corporation for 10 or 20 or 30 years, they will be very hesitant and maybe not have the right skills or mindset to actually disrupt the business.
Organizational bias that they cannot disrupt.
And what are the skills they should be looking for then?
Well, it is a really difficult role to play, because one, you need someone in your that knows the industry and how it works. So it's not enough to get a creative person in. You need to have someone who really understands the industry and what isn't working. But you also need someone who you set up for success. So their success lies in how much they experiment and not how much they catch stuff that you can recognize.
That's the incentivization.
Exactly. are you experimenting enough? So if you take soccer as an example, you should measure on how many shots you have at the goal and not how many goals you make. And that's, I think that is
totally
the big,
different KPIs.
It is. And traditional organization measures on the goals, and these more agile departments or innovative venture departments, they should measure on how many shots you have on the goal.
Yeah.
And that's just two different ways of working, which we need to merge in the future of organizations. So back to your question, if I remember it right.
I don't, so...
Good, good. But fast forward or fast rewind, I think what you need to make sure is that the people who lead these departments are set up for success on what they really need to achieve. So make sure it's okay they experiment also after 2 years. And the people that are dependent on, you're depending on inside the organization, they need an incentive for helping and supporting. Because as a corporation, your real value towards startups, if that's your focus area, is the knowledge and the people and the data you have and the customers you have. And if you're not able to take that knowledge out to the people you're collaborating with on the outside, you're devaluating your exercise.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to get people to deliver that data and that knowledge and those resources from the inside, you need to give them some kind of incentive or
measure.
What's
the fear? Why don't companies do that already?
Well, look at ourselves. We're busy people. Why should I be helping you achieve your goals if I don't get any recognition? I need to pay my my wages. I need to pay all the other things. I have teenage kids. They're expensive. I'm not gonna risk that to create a success for something I don't understand, for a person I don't know, in a market with technology I haven't even heard about. Why should I? And I'm gonna be punished by my manager if I don't deliver what I promised.
Yeah. There's a whole system that's standing in the way.
Yes, and I would totally go into that system and become similar. So we have so many innovative, creative, entrepreneurial people inside organizations, but we don't set them up for that skill or that success.
No. I spent 4 months at the start of 2000, and my New Year's resolution 2017 was to meet a new Danish person or a new Danish business every day for coffee. And
2 years later,
months,
you've reached everyone in Denmark, right?
I managed to do every day for a year and a half, and then time got away from me. But I'm still doing the coffee, just not with new people every day. But the first 4 months I spent on going into companies and doing particular industries. And what really struck me quite quickly was that in many Danish businesses, there were loads of problems that are really, really close to their core business that they just weren't dealing with. And at first I thought they just weren't seeing them. But then I realized that they were seeing them, but because of the way wages are structured in this country, although it's a great system, it doesn't work well with innovation because we can't really pay someone when we don't know if they're going to produce something.
Mm.
How do you deal with a system that isn't set up for innovation?
Mm. It is the $1 billion question. And I think when we're looking at the trends within the future of work, this is exactly what we need to address. I think in Denmark it's much more liberal than in the States. In the States you have to come in before the boss and leave after the boss to be a good employee. It doesn't matter how much you produce, but face time is what you're measured on.
Yeah, sure.
At Denmark it's in
pseudo-arbeit,
yes.
Our friend Dennis calls it.
And in some organizations, I won't mention any names, but the more traditional Danish, it's the same. Working at home is seen as, oh, you're having a day off. So I think trusting people's ability to deliver and trusting people's skills and passion, we need to figure out new ways of measuring it so we don't have to have that physical control and to have KPIs that restrict that we're actually doing the right thing. Because if you create KPIs on something, quantitative goal you need to reach, you're going to do that. And
sure,
if you see stuff on the side that might be much more important, you're not going to do it because then you're not going to have your job,
yeah,
at that point, or get your bonus or your salary. So I think what we've seen from the startup world is that they're focusing much more on, in Google they work with OKRs, which is stretch goals. So we're going to create a crazy goal, and we know we're not going to reach it, but it's more to raise the limit. You're also seeing learning targets rather than quantitative targets. So what do we need to learn in order to make the right decisions? Because if you don't nail what you need, your goal needs to be, then you don't eliminate all these areas where you say, wow, it wasn't what we thought we should work on. It's actually this area that's much more interesting. So that's how startups work, because we have limited resources, we have limited money, so we can't afford to set a goal that's fixed. We need to have a learning mindset.
Yeah, that was exactly where I wanted to pivot to, in terms of, you know, there was one thing being a major corporation, having the resources to be able to allocate a department or X amount of employees to Project X. But if you're a startup or a scale-up and you need to bring in that revenue, how do you incorporate that into your strategy from the beginning?
Well, startups are chasing two things: capital to get customers, or customers to get capital. And that's traction is everything. What you need to do is experiment and fail and learn very, very fast all the time, because you need to. Most founders, they start out with an idea, and they will almost all the time change that idea, pivot that idea to something else, because when your idea or thesis meets the market, it's gonna be different. What customers are willing to pay for will be different. The real problems, or the interconnection between problems, you're not able to foresee it before you get out there. So it's much these working methods of Scrum and iterative and all these modern ways of working has come from the startup area, where you actually just make short sprints and, okay, what do we need to achieve next week? What have we learned, and how do we need to pivot our roadmap or strategy in order to get to the next week? And that's very much driven on how can we test our products with customers, and how can we test that they're willing to pay for it as well. So that's the famous product market fit.
But that's idea testing, right? Mm. And not problem finding.
Yes. And I think what happens along the way is that you start with idea thinking, and then you understand it's not the idea that's relevant. That's just a symptom of the problem. You need to understand the problem very well.
Yes.
And that's back to what I mentioned before with Google X, which is brilliant at doing that. But also what we see of trends is that ideas are cheap, scaling is hard. And what we need to understand is what problems do we want to pay for getting solutions for in the market? And pivoting into what we're seeing out there is the way of looking at problems has also reached the public sector and the private sector in terms of what I call the mission-oriented innovation, which is also supported by a very, very savvy economist called Mariana Mazzucato, which has made a model around mission-oriented innovation, which is more looking at what problem do we need to solve and how can we curate solutions for that. Because if you only look at one idea, you're going to miss the broader picture.
And that's where the SDGs give a fantastic framework
exactly
for collective societal problems to work with.
Yes, and for the first time, I don't know if it's in history, but as I know, everyone are referring to the same goals across sectors.
Yeah.
I know there's a lot of people, even though I probably overestimate how many people knows about the SDGs, whoever I talk to knows about it, whether it's in the educational system, the startup system, the corporate system, venture capital.
I've never heard it so much as I hear it now, but I've never had a podcast before either, so maybe that's connected.
And when you say now, is that within the...
Recently. The last 6 months.
And I think
I
think that's what happens, that when... It just reached some kind of buzzword effect as well. So every company right now is talking about the SDGs,
but
startups.
The algorithm seems clear. How do we maximize human well-being and flourishing? We have these 17 SDGs to achieve this. And now we're going to put technology and human capital at the service of achieving that.
Mm.
And I think it seems ethical and admirable.
Yes.
As opposed to we're going to harvest data and manipulate for our own personal well-being.
Yes, and I think what we're also seeing right now is a lot of greenwashing or rainbow washing, which is companies saying, we are taking out data and manipulating and doing all that. We're just going to call it something. Well, we're saving a tree somewhere, so we're an SDG something company.
What's rainbow washing?
Rainbow washing is because the 17 goals have a color, an individual color.
Right.
And that's the rainbow that you're putting over your product or your company and saying, we're amazing.
But isn't that the classic CSR report where it's just some bullshit bullet points?
Yeah.
And I think contrary to the core business?
It is, but if we're doing this right, it's going to move into the core business. So the CSR department is not going to work on these sustainable areas. It's going to be the core business figuring out how can we do good and make money at the same time. And what we must remember, which a lot of companies also, even startups and corporations, it's across the board, they're forgetting, is that it's not enough to have one SDG or two SDGs you're focusing on. Because if you're doing great stuff in healthcare, but you're wrapping all your medicine into plastic, your outcome will be a minus and not a sure. plus. So you have to look across the SDGs and saying, how are we affecting the water or the plastics of the world or the contamination or whatever it is. We need to look at our business holistically and think, do we have a positive outcome on the world or a negative outcome? And that might go across 7, 10, even 17 SDGs.
What are your thoughts, this is a pivot, on a universal wage? It strikes me that lots of innovation is slowed down through fear, and fear is generally based on security. Do you think the universal wage is a thing that would speed up innovation and speed up resolution of problems and reduce fear?
I actually, this is a creative exercise, but I think our data is our best way to get that universal salary sure. or wage.
UBI, yes. Universal Basic Income.
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Yes, UBI. Thank you, Thomas. Because if you look at it today, and that's where technology can actually play a role, because sure. all the data that I have around my individual person, if I could put a technology and blockchain, the technology, not the crypto, on that, and say, if anyone needs my data for research within science, I'm going to give it for free. If Facebook or Twitter or some commercial entity wants my data, they need to pay me for it. If someone wants to use my data for medical research, I need to get paid as well. So if you can put a price on your data and you can get paid micropayments for every time your data is being used, you're actually going to distribute some of the wealth that's happening today. Hmm. So that could be a UBI, one way of doing UBIs in the future. And I think we're going to see these more creative models. I don't think, and I have, it's just my subjective opinion, but I don't think we're going to have a company or public sector that's going to pay out money around the world. It might happen in sure. Denmark, which is already is in some way, but it's not sustainable. We have to think smarter, and we have to distribute wealth in a more savvy way, because more people are getting very, very rich,
yes.
and we're losing entire populations. And how can we distribute some of the wealth that they're achieving based on the masses out to the masses again? And I think technology can play a role in that challenge. Did that at all answer your question?
Absolutely.
Guys, this is fascinating, and we could probably talk all day and go in a million directions, I think, but I'm mindful of the time, and I think it's a good time to take a quick break and come back with a quick fire round to round out the podcast.
Studying for an executive MBA at Henley Business School in Denmark is an intense and rewarding experience. If you want to achieve the best possible outcomes in business and in life, Henley can give you the skills and knowledge you need through the Henley MBA. For more information, visit henley.dk.
We are back with our quickfire round. The questions will be quickfire. Your answers don't need to be. But do you have any habits, routines, or rituals that you do on a daily, weekly basis to keep yourself physically or mentally sharp?
Yes. So I'm probably a bit of an addict to exercise. So my morning routine is push-ups. What do you call it? Ab work,
sit-ups,
and squats, stuff like that, just for having a baseline.
Not that I know personally, I just heard of people.
That's exactly what they call it. I had the Danish word in my head. So that's just my foundation. But my passion is tennis. So if I could do anything different in my life, I would see if I could become a professional tennis player. So I play as much as I can, as often as I can. I'm injured right now, so now I just run instead. But I met a
tennis elbow.
Yes, I met a ball machine and I couldn't stop, so I was just playing 5 hours in a row for many, many, many days during the summer, and that I was too old for that. Then I just recently, a month or a month and a half ago, started meditating, which I really suck at, because I'm the focus is just everywhere. But I think it's I had a friend who inspired me to do it. He said it's not like an OS upgrade, so an operative system upgrade on your computer. It's like a BIOS upgrade. And for anyone who's a tech geek knows that the BIOS is the absolute foundation and fundamental thing of any machine. So I got intrigued by that if you want to really recode your neural state, it should be through meditation. So I actually do that every day.
He found the right sales pitch for you, by the sides of things.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so that's my routine.
Can you feel a difference in terms of your performance, level of stress, since you've started meditating?
I think it's too short to say I can feel a difference, but I can feel I'm more mindful of my state. So am yeah. I all over the place, or am I focusing, or what thoughts do I have right now? Yeah. Are they productive, or should yeah. I try
so
not to
meta-awareness of where you're
yes,
at?
Yes, some kind of
And what does your practice look like? Does it have any structure to it, or is it just randomly, now's the time I sit down?
No, I have an app, of course. Yeah. I am a little bit of a geek after all. So I use an app called Headspace. So I choose, sometimes I wake up too early in the morning, so I have a try to get fall back into sleep in the morning or in the evening. That's typically when I do it. So it's very much at night or very, very early.
Have you had any one event or experience in your life that you would attribute to a major leap forward in your career or the person you've become?
That's a good question. I think the person I've become is very much, of course, from whom I'm raised off, my mom and dad. I had a few. My real dad died when I was five, so I got a new dad. So I think every adult in my life influenced me. But I think my mother is probably the one that influenced me the most. She's always been, whatever I came home and said I wanted to do, she said, that sounds amazing, you're going to do great. Unfortunately, said it a little bit too many times.
She sounds American.
Yeah, she lived in the States for a while, but no, she is actually Danish. Yeah. And I think that just gave me some kind of, back to the bias, some kind of initial experience or idea of the round. I'm not afraid of failing. I'm not afraid of trying. I'm not afraid of scrapping all thing that's steady to start something new, which is good and bad. Sometimes I'm too much of the other, but I think she probably gave me the courage in life to follow my passion that I've been doing ever since.
That's a wonderful gift to give your child.
Yeah, I'm trying to pass it on. I really, really hope I pass it on. So it's a little bit of the Pippi Longstrump mentality, right? I haven't done it before, so I'll probably be great at it. I think that's the mindset. And events, I think, I have, talking about courage and failure, I have tried a lot of stuff and also failed because I forgot that you also need to have the skills or the tools. So I from my early years, I opened my first business when I was 18, and I failed horrendously. And that's what was within fashion, which was my first career choice. And that actually made me go into technology because I had to pay some money back to the bank. So I had to be adult and think out what I could not only be passionate about, but also where do I send some kind of level of living that is higher than fashion. So I got the understanding of it's not enough to have courage. You really also need to be disciplined and know the groundworks of things. So when I started in technology in 96, I became a systems engineer within TCP/IP protocols and mail exchange. So I read thousands and thousands and thousands of pages on how protocols work. And of course, I also practice it as an engineer in a company. But I think that just that you could read so much about something that little, and I think that has created the foundation for me. I understand a lot of technologies, even though they're new, because the structures are many. That can be referred back to some of the...
And getting the first principles.
Yes, exactly. But I think... and I'm really geeky about stuff, so when I need to prepare for something I don't know, I over-research because I really, really want to understand stuff. So I think that's that courage and not being afraid of failing combined with understanding you also need to be good, otherwise you will fail.
What's something weird about you?
Where do I start? I think most people think I'm an extrovert, but I'm actually much more introvert than I am. So I need to get back from go away from social interactions after a while. You have the same, but I think some people can find it a little bit weird that sometimes I'm just overstimulated socially, so I become a little bit more silent and go into the background. So at some conferences where I know I need to get out there and network, I just go. I was at Web Summit last year. It was too much. I need to get out of there.
I used to find smoking really helped.
I smoked as well once, but I stopped that beautiful habit. So
why? What's wrong with smoking?
Exactly.
Health-wise.
It's the medicine of introverts.
Yes, exactly. That's how we got friends. I didn't get any friends. What's weird about me besides that? Well, I can do pretty crazy stuff, but I won't say it here. unusual crazy stuff. I learned to speak Faroese.
Faroese?
45,000 people speaks that language.
So you must love to travel there to show it off?
No, I met a sailor when I was 17. So he is Danish, and he got a job in Faroe Islands, so I moved with him because of love. So I've tried to be a love immigrant as well. I'm looking at you two expats.
Yeah.
They already know we're weird.
Yeah.
What was the best piece of business or life advice you ever received?
I think the best business advice is from my former boss at DSB. She said to me, you can't have power and recognition. You have to choose what you want. And if you give away recognition, you can typically get the power. And that, I think that's the best advice for being in any organization, especially a political organization, that if you want to get power into what you produce, you need to make sure someone else gets the credit.
Excellent.
Typically your boss.
Yeah.
You are at a dinner party. You can invite two people, alive or dead. Who do you invite and why?
I think I would invite Desmond Tutu. Do you remember him?
Yes.
Yes.
The Archbishop from South Africa.
Yes. And the other one I would invite would be... Who would I really, really love to meet?
Why don't you tell us why Desmond Tutu?
Yes, and I'll make my subconscious think about the other one. Well, I think what Desmond Tutu, he... I'm not a religious person in that way. I do believe in something that's greater than us. But Desmond Tutu once said that religions, I'm not going to say this exactly as he said it, but kind of. But he said, so God is like an elephant, and every religion is some part of the elephants. Together, we might explain what God or that bigger thing is, but we cannot do it as an individual religion. And I think that's how I have it. I feel about spirituality and religion is that I believe in something bigger than us, but I don't think we're able to describe it, and not one religion has the answer to it either. But I would really like to meet him and talk to him to understand. I think he understand how he sees that he's humanity, how he sees ethics, values, and the benefits of religion and spirituality in our society today, which we're lacking a little bit.
He's still alive, right?
I'm not sure. I don't.
Oh yeah.
He's suggesting he's available for dinner.
Yeah,
it's possible we could arrange a dinner.
Yeah, and the other one, I want to say Napoleon. I don't know if it's the political correct answer, but
perfectly legitimate.
I think it's more of curiosity. I think he was a megaloman. Is that what you could say?
Yeah. Megalomaniac.
Megalomaniac, as many other leaders are. But I think that. It's more probably the historical period of time, understanding how you conquered worlds and how you were an emperor and you, the way of living, the way of ruling, the way of achieving things. That would be an interesting historical journey to investigate. And I think I would really love to go back in time and I would probably not live for long, but just experience how
few people did.
Exactly.
Quality over quantity.
I would probably have been hanged or something.
Yes.
I think those two.
What book or books have you most gifted, or have you most been influenced by?
That's a good question.
Is it The Singularity Is Near?
No. I'm much more into stuff about human behavior. I think that's very interesting. I think one book that has influenced me is John Cacioppo's book, Loneliness. I interviewed him for my book, Homo Digitalis, but he's a social neurologist, and he's combining biology with sociology and neurology, which is pretty uncommon.
Yeah.
But what he talks about is that we all fear to be lonely, and we can be lonely in a relationship but still have the feeling, and we can be alone in life but not feel lonely, and what his research has been covering is that our chances of surviving if we're sick or get an injury we live longer if we have a sense of not being lonely. So loneliness kills, in other words.
Sure.
I think that's just understanding what, and I'm very, really curious about that, but that's what are our basic needs, what are our basic fears, and how does that influence the way we react? And especially in business environments, we normally never reach the depth of what the real challenge is. We're always surfacing people's fears and identity. And
you need to read The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker.
I will.
The death drive as underpinning every fear.
I would love to read that, but I think that's super interesting. Is what prevents us from making the right decisions, if there are right decisions, but why are we so biased and subjective as we are? So that's one book. Another book that I've off my shelf, I have a few. I'm thinking about a business book, but that's a little bit boring. I think Synchronicity by Jung. You remember that one?
Yeah.
I think that's the book that's probably I thought most about after reading it. But it's about that how unrelated things happen but has a connection. And I discover that all the time, that that things happen just when you thought about it. It seems like a déjà vu, but it's not. It's you met someone that just met another person, or you're meeting a person who has the same thought as you have. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I think that synchronicity is a very, very interesting phenomenon, that we are, again, back to spirituality, that sometimes things just occur for strange reasons we can't explain. But there's something around being connected as human beings that we're not talking so much about. I think from a business book perspective, you mentioned two, but there are so many business books. But right now I'm reading The Value of Everything with Mariana Mazzucato, which was the economist I was mentioning before, which is very, very interesting, but it's around how value has been created over the past century, and how the people that are benefiting most from financial gains are the people who are not producing anything. Mm, so
yeah.
Bankers, stuff like that, and the people that are actually producing are having the lowest income. So that's a very, very rich understanding on how wealth and the society of today has been established. Sorry, I cheated. Three.
That's a good holiday read, too.
Yeah.
That's the Aaron Rand theory as well, isn't it? Back to Atlas Shrugged, the idea of people who aren't producing making most of the money, and the people who are producing not.
Yes.
Do you have a value principle or quote that you live your life by?
Yes. I always say to myself that if I can think it, I can do it.
That's so funny. I have the same mantra.
Yeah.
In a way. Yeah.
What do you call it?
If I can think it, I can do it.
Yeah, it's the same.
Yeah, that was something
I
adopted a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And I think it's back to my mother. That
I was going to say, that's similar to what your mum used to say.
Yeah, it is. And I think I just adapted that. I created another mantra after being too many years in startups, which is, I don't work with assholes.
That's a good one. Yeah.
Coaching is, if I can help them to think it, they can do it. And it's not based on theories. It's a fact. If you can think it, you can do it.
Yes.
And that's the reason that people struggle to quit smoking, for example, isn't the addiction. It's because they can't imagine a future,
yes,
and the socially stressful situations, they can't imagine it, and as soon as they can imagine it, they no longer need the cigarette.
So it's all the downstream barriers that stand in the way of their narrative
changing. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can I imagine me being a person who doesn't smoke in this situation, and this one, and this one, and this one, and this one?
Does that narrative make sense?
But I think we underestimate narratives and artifacts in our age, because way back when we didn't write or send emails or whatever way we communicated, it was we spread words and learnings through narratives, through stories, and we created stuff. And I think when I look at technology today, what I try to work with is showing and proving that things can happen, because if you can see it, then you'll believe it. But if technology is invisible and our potential futures are not tangible, we're not going to get there. So I think one way of accelerating our evolution with technology is actually proving this can be done, and then fixing the systemic barriers and the incentives and everything else we talked about, because we underestimate that, I think, the power of story and artifacts.
Absolutely.
I'm mindful of the time, and we're going to wrap up the podcast today with one final question, which we ask all of our guests. That is, what do you think Denmark can teach the world, and what do you think Denmark can still learn?
I think I mentioned it a little bit before. I think what Denmark can teach the world is that if you work together on a bigger goal, it can be done. And I think we've seen that with renewable energy and electricity, green electricity, for the past decade. I think we can trace that back to many of the industry leaders that I mentioned before, the great big companies we have in Denmark as well, that we are able to do something that is quite impactful on a global scale, because we get the right ideas and collaborate with the right people across science and business, capital, political games as well. So that mindset or way of collaborating, that everyone is equal and therefore everyone can collaborate, is one thing we can share. And there's some kind of, it's called ordentlighed in Danish, translate that right to English, but we stand for something good and decent. And I think that's...
Decency,
yeah. And what we can learn, we have so, so much to learn. But I think inclusiveness is something we should learn. That I lived in New York for a couple of years, and what I learned there especially, it's always easier to look at your country when you're not living there, but they have just this karma economy, as I call it, that they pay stuff forward. They introduce you to people, they help you with just some kind of subtle belief that it's going to come back to me someday. And we're a little bit more hesitant in Denmark. We're not as supportive and helpful to strangers as you are in many other countries. And there are many good reasons to that based on our culture and history. But that's one area. And I think also understanding that we'll be a richer society if we listen and learn, and if we invite people inside. I think that's probably going to be our biggest challenge, is that we're going to scare people away, and we can't just send more blondes into the world so they marry guys like you. There is a limit to that strategy. So we need to make sure our borders a little bit more open for other reasons.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave it. Before we go, where can our audience find you, follow what you're doing?
Virtually, I'm on @Saxberg on Twitter, and my name can be googled on LinkedIn, or search for LinkedIn and you can connect with me. I have a website, natasha.saxberg.dk. You're welcome to contact me there.
What will people find on your website?
Oh, it's a little bit outdated, but my contact details are there, so you can write me an email. But yeah, they'll find stuff from my background. But on LinkedIn and Twitter, I post my articles and stuff I do.
Natasha Friis-Axberg, a true pleasure. Thank you so much for
likewise
making the trek over here to the studio.
Yeah, it was many steps from my office. Thank you so much.
And to our audience, don't forget to jump over to iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you get your podcasts. Rate, review, subscribe. Help our podcast continue to grow, as we are over tens of thousands of downloads now. So thank you. And until next time, see you on the GDP.
Are you getting the most out of your time in Denmark? Pick up the printed copy of the English language newspaper Copenhagen Post today to access relevant news and event information guaranteed to enhance your working and family life.